So I am going to talk about 56 counties, but I really want to talk about it more in the context of everything that I've written and kind of what some of the themes that have emerged in my work over time. So it's really, I'm revealing my plan to take over the world here. The thing that's always fascinated me about Montana, I'm a third generation Montanan, which somebody asked me the other day, what the hell does that even, what difference does that make? I don't know, but people like to say that here. So both of my great grandparents on my mom's side were homesteaders in the late 1800s. So, you know, there's a long history in my family of stoic, hardworking people. And I just think it's fascinating to try to explore how this place shapes the people that live here. And that's what I really am most interested in, and the thing I probably write about most without even thinking about it. Just as an example, I just recently lost my uncle, who was my favorite uncle. He was also my godfather, and he was a huge mentor to me. He was the family historian. So a lot of what I wrote about in my first two books, especially, which are loosely based on my family, a lot of that information came from him. He was very typical Montanan in a lot of ways, and atypical in a lot of ways too, but I just want to share one story about him. He told me, just before he died, he shared this story. So when he was 10, he and his cousin George, who was 12, they were riding around the ranch on their horses, and they decided to go swimming in this reservoir that his dad had always, you know, told them never to swim in. And so they went swimming, they stripped down and dove in, and they quickly realized why they weren't supposed to swim in there. It was just steep sides. So George was not a very good swimmer. He quickly got into trouble. Lee told him to grab his leg. George grabbed his leg and eventually lost his grip and drowned. So at the age of 10, they recovered the body. And this is the part of I knew about the drowning for forever, but this was the part of the story that he just recently told me. When he went back to the house and all the family and friends were gathering, of course he was inconsolable. He was crying and just felt awful. Not only was it his idea, but he wasn't able to save George. And so he was sitting on the stairway just bawling, and his cousin Rita, who was George's older sister, came and sat next to him and put her arm around him, and she said, "Lee, you're not helping anyone by crying. You're not helping my mother. You're just making things worse." And the amazing thing about that story was that he told me that story as if that was really good advice. when he finished telling it, I was thinking, oh, wow, you must be so mad at her all these years later. And it's like, nope, that was good, sound advice, you know. And it really summed up my uncle. I mean, he always approached emotional incidents with pragmatism and, you know, well, you just put your head down and you keep going. And I think it's a very typical Montana attitude. And then just to take that story one level further, his dad, my grandfather Frank, when he was 14, his older brother, whose name was George, he drowned in the Little Missouri River. He was loading grain, helping a friend, and they found the body like 6 months later. And so my grandfather left school at the age of 14 to go back and work on the ranch. And of course, I never heard him talk about that ever. So he came by that honestly. And, you know, one of the things that I've really come to realize over time is that, you know, you can look at stuff like that and say, well, that's just wrong, you know. But both of these men went on to become, you know, Lee went to an Ivy League school. He was in the Peace Corps twice. He worked all over the world. He was a very accomplished man. And his father was amazing. I mean, he was a fabulous grandfather. So my take on it has always been, well, what's right here, you know? I don't know. A lot of the lessons that they learned as young men seem to work for them. It would drive me nuts holding all that stuff inside, but, you know, that's how they chose to deal with things, and for what it's worth. That's what I try to explore in my work is, you know, how much of the Western myth is, you know, I think it's a bad idea to just say, well, this Western myth is bullshit, you know, that you have to reject the idea that being stoic and strong all the time is a bad thing. We don't know, I think. So I'm going to read a couple passages from my first novel because this book... I used these two drownings as bookends in this book. The first chapter is the drowning of the brother, and later in the book, the nephew drowns, and they're both named George. So I tried to sort of explore the way that they approached it back in the, you know, the first drowning took place in 1916. So this is a short passage from just after that. Young man drown. In our country, there is a quietness, a silence that surrounds you and fills you up, beating inside like blood until it becomes a part of you. The prairie is quiet even during the day, except for the sounds of work, the snort of horses, the clang of a plow's blade against rock, and the rhythm of hooves pounding the ground. But these sounds drift off into the air, finding nothing to contain them, no echoes. It's quieter still at night when you can sit for hours at a stretch and hear nothing except the crickets or the occasional cluck of a chicken. At night, the darkness seems to add to the silence, making it heavier, somehow more imposing. It's a silence that can be too much for some, especially people who aren't fond of their own company. And it seems that living in such silence makes you think twice before speaking or laughing or crying, because when sounds are that scarce, they carry more weight. So like most people I know, we Arbuckles don't say much, especially in times of tragedy when no one knows what to say anyway. When something leaves us wondering, we mostly sit and stare across the prairie as if somebody might come along and explain a few things. This stoic silence does not come naturally to some people. In those early homestead days, it led to frequent cases of the loneliness or suicide. And although most of us talked about these afflictions as if they only happened to newcomers, we all knew better. We all lived with a constant awareness of how vulnerable we were, all of us. It didn't take a genius to notice that some of the sturdiest had been broken down by the pervasive weight of unpredictable weather, uncooperative livestock, and more than anything, that silent wondering about all these byproducts of life on the prairie. And this is another short passage that is right after the second drowning. So it's toward the end of the book. This novel is called In Open Spaces, by the way. Grief, it seems to me, grows much the same way a child does. To begin with, neither can speak, although both are adept at making their presence known, sometimes subtly, sometimes dramatically. The message may not be clear, but the depth of feeling, the passion, is never in doubt. As it grows and ages, grief develops a voice of its own, a voice that needs an attentive, patient ear to hear it. And if it is ignored, the voice will eventually demand attention until one day you turn around to find yourself looking it squarely in the face. There is no choice in this progression. The progression happens whether you permit it or not. The choice comes in how you respond. Some, like my brother Jack, will always run from grief. Others bury it so deep that it makes them weak, and they need someone stronger to rely on. I think before the day of George's drowning, I was running in my own way. His death brought me face to face with sorrow, and my grief grabbed me by the ears and shook me awake. It forced me to stand still for a moment and notice it, to take it seriously. Because practicality can only explain death to a point. If a death puts an end to suffering, as with my sister Katie or my neighbor Art, or as in the final chapter of a long good life, as with my mother, it's easy to explain it practically and sensibly. But when there's nothing sensible about death, such as George's, it leaves you with nothing to hide behind. The pain is right there. And that day, in a strange way, the pain felt good. It felt right. I didn't fight it. I didn't feel like crying. Unlike 30 years before when my brother died, I wasn't rebelling against some latent desire to weep. I was sad as hell, but I knew it was right to feel that way. I knew I was supposed to be sad as hell. And I think that was the one and only day that I knew this absolutely. Okay. So 56 counties came about, actually. It was an idea that Lee, my uncle, suggested to me right after this first novel came out. He said to me one day, he said, "You should drive around every county in Montana and write about it." And I was actually dating an editor at the time, and so I told her about it, and she said, "Nobody would buy that." She proved to be wrong, thankfully, but it was a long time before, when I moved back to Montana in 07, and I couldn't let go of that idea. I just really wanted to explore this place because I had been gone for 25 years, and I felt like I didn't really know Montana as well as I thought I did. So when I suggested it to Alan, and he said, "Yeah, I'd buy it. I'd publish that," I was so thrilled, and I was very fortunate to get I did a Kickstarter campaign to pay for my travels, and people were very kind. And so I was able to travel to every county, interview people. I did a lot of reading about the history of the state, and the book ended up being a lot different than I thought it would be. I was planning just sort of a county-by-county analysis, but when I started writing it that way, it was really, really boring. So I tried a couple other approaches, and I finally ended up breaking the chapters out by industry. So there's an industry about farming, logging, the railroads. There's one about Native Americans. And, of course, the interesting thing about that is that there were themes that emerged that were consistent through all of those various industries. So there's sort of a pattern that seems to repeat itself over and over again here in Montana. And it was interesting to see that develop and to be able to talk about that. So I'm going to read a couple passages from this book. This is the introduction. "I have a secret to share with you. It's about this whole Montana mystique, the magic of this place. I've lived in 12 different states in the past 30 years, and I've always been amazed at how people respond when they hear I'm from Montana. Not always, of course. Some people can't even place Montana. They sometimes know it's near Canada, and others see it as just another small part of that big empty space between New York and California. But I often came across people who said, 'Oh, I love Montana.' 'Have you been there?' I asked. 'No, but it looks so beautiful in the pictures. I've always wanted to go.' And of course, there are the inevitable questions, sometimes entirely baffling. A friend of mine was recently asked, 'Do you guys have grocery stores there?' Montana is a place whose vast expanses are really impossible to comprehend until you've been here. I was recently talking to someone who works at the wind farms in Wheatland County, and he told me about the owner of the company coming from Chicago to visit the work site. He said he was going to catch a cab from the airport in Billings. That's 150 miles, in case you didn't know. I said, I don't think you want to do that. So he asked me whether there was a train. And I said, no, I'll tell you what, I'll just come and pick you up. Another friend tells a story about when he first moved to Montana and he had to drive to Great Falls for business. This guy was giving me directions and he said to turn left at Eddie's Corner. So I asked him what that was and he says, oh, it's just the gas station. And I thought, wait, I'm driving 200 miles to get to this town and I'm supposed to pick out one gas station and know where to turn? But of course, when I got to Eddie's Corner, it made complete sense. For decades, the West, and Montana in particular, has developed a reputation as a place where you can go to start over, to create a whole new persona, or become the person you've always envisioned. It's the kind of place where a week-long trip to one of the more picturesque locales fuels the imagination. The fresh air, the huge sky, and the wide open space instills in you a belief that anything is possible. It's a place where starting over can move from concept to reality in the course of a walk around Bozeman or a drive along Flathead Lake. But here's the secret. The secret is that we Montanans are completely bipolar. That's right, we're up and down like a goddamn bucking horse. Not all of us, of course. But as a state, as one big entity, we are completely manic depressive. Why do I say that? Well, in February of 2014, Gallup did a survey to determine the happiest states in America, and Montana finished number one. That's the idea you get when you visit this place. People are friendly as hell. They really do seem happy. You rarely get that shiver up your neck where the friendliness seems to be hiding some slimy ulterior motive. People in Montana let you go first because it doesn't matter whether they go first. They smile at you on the street because there's no good reason not to. But here's the other side of it. That same year, 2014, several studies listed Montana in the top three for suicide. And for the last 40 years, we've been in the top five every single year. So what the hell does that mean? How is that possible? How can the place that's the happiest in the whole country? What? Well, that's one of the many things I wanted to address in this book. For one thing, there seems to be an inherent pressure when you live in Montana to be happy. Seriously, if you can't be happy here, what the hell's wrong with you? But of course, it's way more complicated than that. Much of the explanation goes back to the very beginning, when Montana first came into being, or at least the current form of Montana, when it was settled. From the start, the narrative about our history has been altered or often completely rewritten in order to support the actions of certain people or certain groups of people. From the start, those who wrote our history were so intent on shining a bright light on Montana that they ignored many of the pertinent facts, particularly the shadows. And perhaps the most troubling aspect of this is that many of those who wrote or made movies about the West, and particularly about Montana, didn't even live here. From the time Owen Wister came out with The Virginian, which is considered the first great Western, writers have been presenting the stereotypical Westerner as stoic, self-contained, multi-talented, and completely cool under pressure. But Wister was a lawyer from back east, a law school friend of Teddy Roosevelt's who came west a few times as a rich tourist. He actually wrote that book in a gentleman's club in Philadelphia, so that, I always thought that was funny too. The American West was built around misconceptions and misdirection. And although most of us who live here know this by now, especially after decades of wonderful historians digging deep enough to tell the real story, many of these misconceptions still persist, not only here, but worldwide, because they've become an important part of the American culture. They still justify certain behaviors. They romanticize the idea that men who ride into town and take care of business are the kind of men we need. The number of American presidents and other world leaders who have posed on horses or in various Western activities is hilarious and frightening. From Reagan chopping firewood to Putin sitting shirtless in the saddle, I'll add shooting prairie dogs. Leaders have found ways to align themselves with the old John Wayne mentality. And it seems to work. It tells the public, I'm a man of action. I can handle an axe, and I look good on a horse. Look at Teddy. He was actually known as the cowboy president. And he not only relished that image, but he perpetuated it. Partly because it was based on fact, because he lived it for a while. But there was a dark side to Teddy Roosevelt's time out west, and that contradiction fits right in with our whole bipolar history. Roosevelt moved here and built a cattle ranch when he was still in his 20s, after he lost both his wife and his mother on the very same day in the same house. He spent the next several years immersing himself in a world of physical labor, raising cattle and hunting like a fiend. The number of animals Roosevelt killed in his time out west is estimated in the thousands. It doesn't take a professional to figure out. There was probably some escapism going on there. Roosevelt never mentioned his wife's name again as long as he lived, even in his autobiography. So you could say it worked for him. But none of us will ever know how much pain he buried over these tragic events. It could very well be what drove him to accomplish as much as he did. It's well documented that he was a man who couldn't sit still. Many wonderful journalists and historians have told this story before, and this is intended as just one more contribution to the growing narrative about Montana. It's just one man's take on the contradictions and the complexities that are Montana. Because a story this big and this complicated needs to be told over and over again. Okay, so this first, the next chapter, I'm just going to read a little bit from that. And this is about the vigilantes and the big gold rush. It sort of starts off the whole theme, many of the themes that emerged over and over again in the book. Today, at first glance, it's impossible to imagine that the 60-mile stretch between Bannock and Virginia City could inspire the kind of greed that led to dozens of men being hung. There's nothing the least bit remarkable about the area where Bannock sits now, which no doubt explains why nobody lives there anymore. But for several years, this area was the number one destination for people moving west. It's even harder to imagine when you consider that most of these pioneers traveled thousands of miles, mostly by horse and wagon, but often on foot, before there were actual roads. It's impossible to imagine until you understand the reason, which was, of course, gold. In May of 1863, a small group of grubby miners found gold in Alder Gulch, near where Virginia City and Nevada City sprang up, and word spread so quickly that the population of these three towns, Bannock being the third, which were then part of the Idaho Territory, swelled to around 10,000 people in the next 3 months. The following year, prospectors pulled $10 million worth of gold from the creeks and rivers between Bannock and Virginia City, an astonishing sum for that time, approximately $230 million in today's money. Over the next 5 years, the amount extracted from the mines in that area was estimated to be between $30 and $40 million. But one of the more interesting aspects of that period is how many different groups of people converged on this place at the same time. When we think of the native population that was already there, many people just think Indians. But it was much more complicated than that. There were many different tribes. It had only been 30 years since President Andrew Jackson initiated the Indian Removal Act, a blatant combination of coercion, bribes, and massaging of laws, wherein thousands of Native Americans were forced to leave the regions where they had lived for generations.
The Dakota War, where the U.S. cavalry clashed with the Sioux in the Black Hills, had just taken place the year before the Alder Gulch Gold Rush. And the Sand Creek Massacre was just around the corner. A good percentage of these natives had been directed toward what is now Montana, and they were not happy about it. Each tribe had been designated their own territory, which was determined by the government with little thought to these people's needs. And although they had developed a mutual respect for each other's territories, many of these tribes did not like each other, and they often battled. So there was already a volatile atmosphere that permeated this part of the country. People were already living in fear, in constant state of fear. Add to this an incredible variety of people who flocked to the West with the news of gold. The Western films like to portray most of the pioneers as good family folk just wanting to get their hands on a nice piece of land to build a life for themselves. And of course, there was that demographic. But that was not the typical resident of Montana in the 1860s. Most of the early white folks that came to Montana were single men who were looking to get rich. They were deserters from the military or disgruntled Civil War veterans, particularly from the South, who were pissed off that they just lost the war. They were men with criminal records or men who were trying to escape families that didn't want them around. They were men who had failed in their search for gold in California but hadn't given up on the dream. They were from Germany and Ireland and the Scandinavian countries. They were from China. The old movies like to portray all of the inhabitants of the West talking with the old Western drawl that we've come to know. But it probably sounded a lot more like modern-day San Francisco, with every language and accent imaginable, and with it every cultural and ideological concept imaginable. The possibilities for conflict were endless. People tend to assume that most of these men were rough and crass and only cared about such things as drinking, fighting, and prostitutes, but there's plenty of evidence to the contrary. The diary of Ichabod Borer, written by a prospector who moved to Virginia City from Ohio in 1864, reveals a spirit of camaraderie among the prospectors that is surprisingly tender at times. At several points in Borer's account, he talks about how lonely he is when his partners are off working in other areas of the state. There are even entries that describe men standing in a group and weeping openly because one of their friends has decided to go back home. That's not a scene you'd ever see in a John Ford movie. You know, and it was interesting to me, too, because I read a couple of other personal accounts that from those early days that had scenes where grown men, you know, were standing around grieving the loss of a friend. And I've always been curious about when things started to shift with that whole dynamic. You know, I think Wister's novel for sure was part of it. With the, you know, the Virginian, if any of you have read that, it's like Clint Eastwood. I mean, it's pure Clint Eastwood. The guy is stoic. He never shows any emotion. And so, anyway, I just find that whole process fascinating. How did we get there? Okay, I'm going to read one more short passage here from this book. As most of you know, Eastern Montana and Western Montana are different. This chapter is called Plants. There is no line marking the change from Western Montana to Eastern Montana. Whether you're driving along Highway 2 from Kalispell to Cutbank or traveling east along Highway 90 from Bozeman, you won't see a sign that says, "Welcome to Eastern Montana," but you will notice the difference. I used to say that Eastern Montana was flat until I married a woman from Savannah, Georgia. When I brought her to Montana and we drove across the eastern part of the state, she said, "This isn't flat. This isn't flat at all." I couldn't grasp how she could say that until we did a similar road trip through Georgia. Of course, she was right. Although there are definitely long stretches, especially on the High Line, where you can see for miles, the terrain in eastern Montana is almost never flat. There are subtle changes everywhere. A big reason for its reputation is the lack of trees. You can drive for hours without seeing as much of a handful of trees, and those are generally shelter belts that were planted to give someone's ranch home a little relief from the wind. But a closer look at this half of the state reveals a land that is rich with texture. Whether it's a long, delicate slope or a hidden coulee, there are indications everywhere that the elements have been hard at work. But much of eastern Montana is an acquired taste, especially if you expect the majesty of the mountains. This kind of open country seems to attract two very different types of people and create two kinds of towns. First, there's a town like Fort Benton, where every place you go, people greet you like a long-lost relative. There are many small towns like this in eastern Montana where the people appear to be living rich, happy lives. The other extreme is a little harder to grasp, and to the outsider, I'm sure it can be intimidating. But in most of the smaller towns in eastern Montana, what you're going to encounter when you first walk into the local cafe is the stare. Those who encounter the stare should not panic. Although at first glance, the stare suggests you might want to turn around and go back to your car. The explanation is pretty simple. The stare comes from seeing the same 25 or 30 people day after day for the past 5 or 10 years. They're suddenly presented with someone they've never seen before. You're a specimen that needs to be studied and analyzed. The stare may seem rude at first, but it's really a compliment. You're something they're going to spend a good hour talking about later. There's another factor that contributes to the stare. Economics. A few years ago, I read that every county east of Billings, except Custer, which is Miles City, had decreased in population since the 1950s. I'm sure that's with the oil boom, this is no longer true. But that trend is still very much alive for most of eastern Montana. According to Business Insider, the average wage among Montana residents is the fourth lowest in the nation, and eastern Montana's average is lower than the western half. The natural result is a large number of people that are struggling and unhappy, maybe depressed. Some are drinking too much. Many are angry at the government, at each other, at themselves. It's a part of the cycle of economic struggle, and most of eastern Montana has been fighting this battle for a long time now. So don't take it personally if they don't greet you with a smile and a cheery greeting. Okay, one more section of this, and then I'm going to read a little bit of something brand new. This is the very end of the story, but it's not going to give anything away, so don't worry. Montana has so much beauty. One look at some of the splendor that exists in this place, and you find yourself searching for words. And it's not just the landscape. What is most beautiful about this place is the spirit of it. The way people here love so hard and so thoroughly, whether it's the land or their families or their country, they love it until it makes them blind, until they feel the need to barricade themselves against anything that threatens that love. They love with hearts so full that the blood can pump up and swell their view of themselves. The vast openness of this place can inspire your imagination until you believe you can accomplish anything. I've often driven across the eastern part of the state and thought about how riding across this country on a horse for weeks at a time could have given the imagination of someone like Custer so much time and room to grow that it blew up beyond the boundaries of a rational mind. Many people don't realize that part of what inspired Custer to make that harebrained charge was his growing ambition to become president. He had many people urging him to run, based in large part on his previous conquests in battle. So he was hoping to add one more victory to his resume to boost his chances of attaining our highest office. Despite the fact that his company had a desertion rate well over 50%, he was living in a world where he was invincible. Montana is a place that will not let go of you. I moved away in 1996, and for many years after that, I kept renewing my Montana license plates, even though I moved to several different states. I was always so proud when someone asked me about it or gave me a thumbs up from their car. When I was living in San Francisco, someone once left a note on my windshield saying he was from Bozeman and he'd like to meet this other Montana person. So I dropped by his house, and he really grilled me about the license plates. He wouldn't let it go, and I finally realized he was jealous. He wanted Montana license plates. So I guess the final question becomes whether or not I found what I was looking for on this journey. Did I find an idea of what Montana represents, what it means to me or to anyone for that matter? And to answer that, I turn to the two final stories. When I was working on my grandfather's ranch when I was 16, my uncle and I were moving a flock of sheep when one of the lambs broke free. This was early in my time there, so I was ready to prove my skill on a horse. I quickly took off after that little guy, digging my heels deep into my horse's flanks. But when I caught up to the lamb, he abruptly stopped, ran behind the horse, and took off again. I caught up to him two more times before I finally got it through my head this wasn't going to work. I yelled something nasty at him and then turned my horse around and started trotting back toward the flock. And of course, when I turned to see whether he was still running, he was following me back. A couple of days before I finished this book, I watched an 80-year-old woman fall and land hard on the back of her head. She was using a walker, and when she landed, the walker flipped over and hit her in the face. It was a horrific sight unfolding just 10 feet from where I stood, and it brought up all the worst feelings of hopelessness and fear, helplessness. The hardest part of the experience, though, was that it was my mother. We had just finished running some tests at the hospital, where we had spent 3 hours shuttling from room to room. They fit her with an IV and gave her some tests to simulate physical activity so they could take pictures of her heart and determine whether she was strong enough for surgery. The tests had gone well, and they took less time than we anticipated, but she was tired and a little weak from walking more than she usually did. Just before she fell, a man had picked up a form that had fallen from her walker. She was in the process of putting it back into the walker when I showed her where to sit in the waiting room so I could get the car. This combination of events led to her losing her balance, doing a slight pirouette, and falling straight backwards, landing flat on her back. Her head smacked against the marble floor, and I was just one of many who shouted and ran to her. My mother and I have sometimes had a difficult relationship. We've often gone for long stretches without talking, but it's always been me that initiated these silences. She never once stopped talking to me, and each time I decided to talk to her again, she replied without the slightest hesitation. Perhaps because of this past, this incident affected me deeply, and as I left her in the hospital that night, I burst into tears, thinking about the look of terror on her face as she fell. I couldn't stop crying. I felt as if there were so many things I could have done to prevent it. If I had just recognized how tired she was, I could have asked for a wheelchair. Or if I had just stayed with her for those 10 more feet that she needed to walk to the waiting room. But mainly, if I had just had the presence of mind to slow down and notice what was happening. Mothers can be amazing in the way they forgive and still offer what they can. And I can't help but think about the fact that this place we live in is referred to as Mother Earth. I can't help but wonder whether we don't take enough time to slow down and notice how forgiving she can be, no matter how much we ignore the warnings. Like most animals, we are fairly simple when it comes down to it. Some food, a place to lay our heads, a sense of usefulness. It's the world around us that complicates these things. And there are a few places that are as complicated as Montana is. There are also very few places that provide as many opportunities. And when you think about the things we do to utilize these resources, just the verbs themselves indicate a sense of abuse, even violence. We plow, we corral, we break, we excavate, we herd, we cut, and we drill. We cultivate, dam, pluck, and hobble. There are so many things that happen every day, hour after hour, that prove in some small way that we have very little control over what happens in our lives. But when the health and safety of someone we love is directly affected by this kind of powerlessness, it brings home the most basic rule of life, that we are small, insignificant dancers in a very complex and chaotic ballet. But when you live in a place like this, you also eventually learn the futility of trying to tame these elements. You learn that a lamb running from the flock isn't the end of the world, that you aren't going to stop it from doing what it wants to do. You learn that no matter how hard you try to protect the ones you love, they will sometimes fall. And finally, you learn that the best way of getting what you want is by recognizing that we are all only temporary guests here, stewards of this place, and that by treating it and its inhabitants with the respect they deserve, we improve our chances of having them come to us. I'm just going to read two small sections from the book I'm working on now is sort of the final extension of this theme of how Montana shapes us. So it's a memoir, but the basic focus of it is, you know, how has Montana shaped me as a man? And these are two short excerpts from that, the book is called Be a Man. This chapter is called Black Shetlands. My cousin Mike holds a rope leading Toro, the meanest pony in the world, while I sit nervously perched on Toro's bare back. My grandpa Arbuckle bought two Shetland ponies from a local carnival, a gift for his grandkids. But most of us aren't so sure we like this gift. These two ponies don't have a great affection for children or people. The ponies are black, so we have cleverly named ours Choo-Choo, while our local cousins named Toro that name because he mowed the grass in the meadow where he's kept. Mike is the oldest male cousin in our family, so he often takes the lead in our play, but he's a somewhat reluctant leader. Despite being big for his age, he's a nervous boy, always worrying about what's going to go wrong. He leads Toro in a circle in their front yard, gripping the rope while I hang on to Toro's mane and try not to think about getting bitten or bucked off. And then it happens. Toro suddenly bucks, and Mike panics, losing hold of the rope. The next thing I know, Toro is galloping along Polly Drive, a tree-lined street that is one of the busiest in Billings. Cars rush toward me, and I look behind to see a string of cousins running red-faced and frantic, shouting, "Toro! Toro! Toro!" The scene is hilarious now, but as a six-year-old kid, I was terrified, picturing this demonic little pony throwing me into oncoming traffic. Choo-Choo had thrown me to the ground several times during our short relationship, tossing me off like the pest that I was. Putting myself in the horsey shoes of Choo-Choo and Toro, it's easy to imagine why they had no interest in being pets. They had spent most of their lives as carnival ponies, strapped to a merry-go-round, carting bratty child after bratty child in a tight little circle. They must have been dying to buck off as many bratty children as possible by the time they came to our little family, and we were the victims of these victims. As a boy growing up in the West, episodes like this stay with you. You meet young ranch kids who hop up on a full-sized horse like it's the most natural thing in the world, and you wonder what's wrong with you. You wonder whether maybe you're not quite as fearless as you should be, as tough as you should be. These questions can be quite the burden for a kid after they roll around in your crew-cutted head for a few years. One of my favorite stories from childhood was when I was visiting my grandparents' ranch and they took me to a neighbor's to spend the day hanging out with a kid named Kelly Corniman. Kelly and I had known each other our whole lives and always enjoyed each other's company. His mother, Esther, made my first Christmas stocking. That day, Kelly suggested we ride some calves, and I didn't have the gumption to tell him that I'd never done such a thing. So he got me all fixed up with chaps and spurs. He wrapped a rope around the calf's torso, and I gripped that thing with all my boyish strength while he swung open the chute. The calf didn't really buck. It just took off running. And for about 20 yards, I had the situation completely under control. But calves are apparently smarter than they appear. Because right at the end of those 20 yards, he stopped dead, and I went flying, landing flat on my stomach. My legs kicked up behind me, and the spurs popped me square in the back, knocking the wind clean out of me. I think it was the first time in my life that I looked death squarely in the face. And I wasn't ready to go yet. Kelly apparently thought I was going to die too, because he started crying, rolling me onto my back. Then he went for my feet, which I didn't understand. And the next thing I knew, he was pulling off my boots. This story was made better by the fact that Kelly's dad, Donnie, happened to wander down to the barn right about this time. He saw the whole scene. And it became a running joke in both of our families with the classic punchline that Kelly Korneman wasn't about to let his friend die with his boots on. Okay. And one last excerpt. This is called One Time Boy. I've never been so anxious to meet another kid in my life. My parents have told us for years about the family that's about to come and visit. They have a boy my age, and several years ago this boy shot and killed his younger brother when they were playing in the family barn. I've wanted to meet this boy ever since. Our parents introduce us and we nod shyly, and I try to imagine what it's like meeting new people, knowing that they probably know what happened. I wonder whether he can feel how differently people look at him. Maybe he was too young to notice that things changed. Or maybe they didn't change. Or maybe it was impossible for them not to change. Even at my young age, I notice a tension within this family, as if they are bound together with a tight strand of wire, as if a single cut and the wire would spring loose and every one of them would burst into a million pieces. My parents encourage me to take the boy outside, and it's a relief to get away from that tension. It seems to be a relief to him as well, as once we're outside, he talks a bit. We ask the usual questions for 12-year-old boys. What grade are you in? What's your favorite sport? What's your favorite football team? Your favorite TV show? We start to toss a football around, and he even laughs sometimes. I'm happy to see that he can still laugh. And the more we play, the more I realize he's very much like any other boy I've ever met. His father and my father met on the rodeo team in college. His parents are ranch people, and he wears ranch clothes. He has dark hair and a kind of a pointy head. He's a bit awkward and tentative, but he's happy to play, not unwilling to interact. But of course, the weirdest part about this whole afternoon is that the subject hanging over us never comes up. There are so many questions I want to ask this boy. I wonder about his brother. Does he remember what he was like? Does he think about him? Does he miss him? Does he hate himself for what happened? My parents explained that it was an accident. He didn't know the gun was loaded, a pistol. They were playing like so many boys do, cowboys and Indians probably, and bang, the gun did what guns do. It propelled a small piece of metal through the air with such force that it broke right through his brother. It blasted inside him. It killed him. One minute they were laughing, playing with the carefree joy of children, and in an instant this family entered a world that most people can't possibly understand. One minute he was a boy, the next instant he stepped into a wilderness where even adults with a keen sense of direction can get lost forever. But today we play like regular, normal boys. We act as if everything is just as it should be, connected by the simple arc of a football and the delicate thread of a friendship between two men who met in college. As if this boy never had to experience the feeling of watching his brother die. We talk about everything but the fact that he killed his brother. And I know now, all these years later, that the same thing was happening inside our house. Because in this time and place, in Montana in the 60s, people did not broach uncomfortable topics, even with their closest friends. Ranch people didn't burden their friends with their problems. I'm confident in saying that my parents talked to his parents about the ranch, about my dad's new job, about old friends from the rodeo team, and of course, the weather. But not about their dead son. Not about how hard it must have been for them to get out of bed every day and face a world that couldn't possibly understand. I never saw these people again. We heard that the parents got divorced, which is not surprising. I don't know whether our fathers had less in common later when they were grown and raising families. I don't know what happened to that boy. But of all the boys I've met only once in my life, he has occupied more hours in my thought life than any other boy. Thank you.